During the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy paused a moment in the deliberations and called for his dog, Charlie. The dog was sent to Kennedy, and he sat for a long time in silence, stroking Charlie's fur. Those present said Kennedy seemed to relax, and finally he spoke and said, "I suppose that it's time to make some decisions." Well, dogs have been far more than pets to the human race for thousands of years, and this hour we look at that history and celebrate our relationship with our slobbering friends as we talk with the author of the book, The Modern Dog. Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert in this morning for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Dr. Stanley Koren. He's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and is a recognized expert on dog-human interaction. He's the author of several books, including The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today. And we'd love to hear your dog stories today. You can call us up and tell us why you think dogs have mattered so much over the ages, and maybe why your dog in particular is your best friend. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And Dr. Stanley Koren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. There's so many wonderful stories in it. But I want to start with one of your contentions here, which is fascinating. You say that if it weren't for dogs, it may be that Homo sapiens might not have made it. We might be a race of Neanderthals. Flesh that out a little for us. How did that work?
Well, it turns out, you know, you see all the ads and stuff in the TV portrayal of Neanderthals, and they look like these sort of shambling, dumb creatures, but the truth of the matter is that they were actually fairly bright. They had a social organization, and they could make basic sort of primitive tools and weapons and that kind of thing. But one of the things that Neanderthals never did was they never formed an alliance with dogs. The Neanderthal was built in a, you know, as a big shambling beast, and in the sense that he had this muzzle, he had a mouth which was designed to be used as a weapon, and he had better smell than we did. Now, the Cro-Magnons and all the ones who followed after them came along, and they began to form permanent settlements. And around those permanent settlements, they would throw the garbage. I mean, you know, they were good hunters, but they were basically slobs. And they would toss out all the animal parts that they weren't using and that sort of thing into piles, which we call middens. And the great-granddaddies of what would become our dogs, you know, looked at this stuff over there and said, "Hey, wait a minute, look, there's a free buffet. I mean, why should we go out and hunt something when we can just snatch some of this food?" And what happened is they would then start to hang around these settlements and began to consider it their territory. Now, primitive man allowed the dogs to be there because, you know, the dogs eating the garbage kept down the vermin and the smell. But there was an added benefit. And the added benefit was that since the dogs now considered this to be their homes, if somebody approached, a stranger or a dangerous animal or that sort of thing, the dogs would set up a commotion. And these were difficult and treacherous times, and that kind of warning gave a lot of an advantage to a village. They could hear the dogs, all the noise which they made, and rally a defense very, very quickly. Now, Neanderthals never formed that association with dogs, so that when it turned out that the weather began to change, we began to get the Ice Age, the Neanderthals were hunting big animals, and the big animals began to move north and began to die out. They began to raid local areas. And, of course, if they go to raid a Cro-Magnon settlement, there's advance warning. And so they're not very successful at that. They do that a couple of times, and the Cro-Magnons start to consider them to be their enemies and go after them. And, of course, they don't have the dogs to provide the early warning. Furthermore, with the big animals disappearing, the Cro-Magnons developed bows and arrows, but arrows really don't kill, especially not the primitive kinds of arrows that they had at the time. they wound, and they allow you to get close enough to make a kill. But you have to pursue the animal. And, of course, dogs are the perfect beast to go chase wounded animals. So the Neanderthals didn't have them to assist as the hunting became poorer and food became scarcer. The final thing, and this is the most controversial, this is a wonderful theory which has been given by a couple of anthropologists, and that is it has to do with something which we call coevolution, and that is that if we are living with some other species, we can sort of link our evolution. And it turns out that since early man now, the Cro-Magnons now had dogs. Well, dogs had a better sense of smell than the Cro-Magnons did. And the Cro-Magnons had the better weapons, but they also had the dogs with their jaws. So they didn't need these big, heavy muzzles that the Neanderthal had. That allowed them to develop smaller heads, less musculature around the neck and that sort of thing, which gave them more room for a voice box and more flexible lips to shape sounds. And in effect, that then gave them the apparatus to have language. So if you believe those anthropologists, you and I would not be speaking to one another now if it hadn't been for dogs. So, I mean, those are the kinds of speculations. And, of course, you know, they're speculations.
Well, I want to ask you about the relationship that formed between these early Cro-Magnons and dogs. Why not Neanderthals? One would assume that they had scraps of food, that they were no further advanced in their hygienic practices. Why would they not have formed this relationship with dogs? I mean, I guess maybe the bigger question I'm wondering about is there something hardwired in humans to bond with dogs?
Well, those are two really separate questions, and so let's answer them in order. There appear to be several reasons why the Neanderthals did not form an association with dogs. The first one is that the settlements which the Cro-Magnons had were much larger, so they already had sort of an organized hunting kind of a thing. So there were just better pickings to hang around a Cro-Magnon settlement. The second thing is that the Neanderthals were more likely to consider dogs a food source than as a friend. And there's lots of evidence of the fact that in certain Neanderthal settlements, things which look very much like, you know, the wolves or wild canines were being eaten. So, you know, Cro-Magnon sees the dogs out over there and just figures, okay, well, he's cleaning up the garbage. A Neanderthal sees the dogs out over there and says, that's lunch standing there on my garbage pile. So those are possible reasons. Now, about the thing about hardwired to have an association with dogs, that's an interesting question. It is certainly the case that for at least 14,000 years, and maybe 17,000 years, if we believe the latest findings from Russia around Bryansk, human beings have been living in association with dogs and have been domesticating them. And during that process, we have been conducting seat-of-the-pants behavior genetics so that we have been shaping dogs so that dogs are more sociable and more attuned to human beings. I'll give you an example. If you pointed something, the dog looks in the direction you're pointing because he knows that that's a communication gesture indicating that there's something out over there. If you pointed something, a wolf will look at your hand.
Hmm.
That's even if the wolf has been reared from a puppy around humans. Whereas for dogs, by the time they're 6 or 7 weeks of age, they're already looking in the direction that you're gesturing. So what we've done is we have created animals which are attuned to our communication, to our lifestyle, to our emotions, and that sort of thing. So if we've created sort of the perfect companion, there's no wonder, if you will, that we love them. I mean, you know, we've created them mm-hmm. for the perfect fit. So it's the dogs whose genes have been modified for association with humans, and we love them because it's worked.
Well, and you talk about, too, how we bred them to bark, for instance. Not all dogs barked that much initially.
No. In fact, that was a huge problem with the terriers. The job of a terrier is he's got to go, his name comes from terra, meaning earth, and he has to go to ground, which means to say the dog has to go in a burrow after a fox or a badger or whatever else, and then he slugs it out mano a mano with the beast underground. Now, the real problem here is that it's very difficult for a dog to back out of one of these things. So the way that you find out where your animal is and save his life, basically, is you listen to the noise which he's making, and you dig him up. The early terriers didn't bark any more than any other dog, and that was a problem. They were being lost. So they looked for mechanical solutions. Basically, they would hang little bells around the dog's collars. That helped a little bit, but the problem with that sort of thing is the collar and the bell then increase the likelihood you're going to get snagged on a root underground and get stuck there. So instead, they began to breed the dogs so that they barked whenever they became excited. That way, when the terrier went underground, you could hear it barking, you knew where he was at, and you could dig him up. So every single terrier, regardless of his size, really comes out of the womb effectively wearing a T-shirt which reads, Born to Bark.
Well, I want to fast forward a little bit if we can. One of the chapters that I had such a great time reading was the chapter about powerful people and their relationship with dogs, kings and queens and presidents. And just to start us off, why don't we start with JFK. He had a little dog named Charlie. Well, I'm actually not sure if it was a little dog. It was a dog named Charlie. And one of the stories you talk about is how it actually nipped the gardener in the seat of the pants. And when the gardener sort of complained, people told him, oh, forget about it. You know, you're going to be out of here before the dog will.
Yeah. Kennedy's an example of just how strong the relationship can be between people and their dogs. And very often, for people in high places, the dog is a better companion than a human being, because one of the things which you don't have to worry about is you don't have to worry about the dog betraying your confidences or any of that sort of thing. And a huge number of presidents have had dogs as confidants, and I ran across an absolutely wonderful letter which had been written by Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, of course, went on to become president of the United States. And this was when he was still the commander of the Allied forces in North Africa. And he wrote back to his wife, Mame, and he said, I have a little Scottish terrier, and his name is Kiachi. And he is very precious to me. He's the only person that I can talk to without the conversation coming back to this damn war. So, you know, you get that kind of a relationship. And it's a wonderful thing in terms of bringing some peace and comfort to these individuals who are in these high places. And we now understand the science of it. I mean, this is part of the beauty of what's been happening recently. For example, we now know that if you pet a familiar and friendly dog, your heartbeat slows, your breathing becomes more regular, your muscles relax, certain of the cortisone-related chemicals in your blood begin to diminish. In other words, you show all of the effects of reducing your stress level.
Is that true even if you have one of those little spastic dogs that bounces around and yips?
Well, the dog has to be at least calm enough to allow you to pet it, because touch seems to be part of the important thing here. But if he pays attention and you pet him, these effects are virtually instantaneous. Now, compare that to Prozac or those sorts of medications. The buildup to release the stress level takes from 3 to 6 weeks, whereas here we're talking about something which you can sort of measure the effects within 5 minutes. So that's a major advantage, and especially if you're in a high-stress position. There's some wonderful studies which have looked at individuals who otherwise would be socially isolated if it wasn't for the fact that they had dogs. This would be people like elderly people, for example. And we find that they use significantly fewer medical services, and they're only one quarter as likely to become clinically depressed. And there's a wonderful, wonderful study which was conducted up at the University of Pennsylvania. And it looked at men who had had their first heart attacks and then followed up on them for several years. And they found out that at the end of the study, you were much more likely to still be alive if you had a dog. And the argument of these researchers is that that's because we know there's a link between stress and heart problems. And the people with a dog have some sort of outlet to reduce their stress.
That sort of makes all of those stories in your chapter about New Orleans sort of all the more wrenching. The people who were separated from their dogs during that horrible natural disaster. And you have both sides of the fence there. You have stories about people who did manage to keep their dogs with them because they were clever in how they stowed the dogs on these buses and that, where the dogs weren't supposed to go. And, you know, children who were forced to leave their dogs and how heartbreaking that was for them. Can you talk about both sides of what you saw in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina?
Yeah, the Katrina thing was an absolute disaster. People were basically instructed to leave their animals behind, and most of them did. And we had those awful pictures of dogs on balconies and on the rooftops of homes who had been abandoned. And people did not pay any attention to the benefit and the bond that people had between dogs. I remember one of the most striking situations was that little dog Snowball and the little boy and that was caught on film by CNN, I think it was, the family was getting on the bus. The boy was carrying this small dog, which would not have taken up any space. I mean, you know, he sat on the kid's lap. And he was basically told that, you know, he couldn't take the dog, and they couldn't get on the bus with the dog, and they took the dog away from him, and the kid cried, and he cried so much that he actually fell on the ground and started to vomit from stress. It was heartbreaking. Now, there were some people who did recognize it, you know, sort of the most heartwarming story, which I had, which came out of the Katrina mess, were evacuating some people by helicopter from a highway where it should be used as a gathering point. And this elderly woman showed up, and she was carrying a little Yorkshire Terrier. And the trooper said, "I'm sorry, ma'am, you know, no animals allowed." And the woman said, "You know, well, you know, he's all I got. You know, I have no family, and this is all I have." And the trooper was distressed, but he said, "You know, I'm sorry, my orders are that no animals are around." And then behind him, an officer wearing wings of a medical corps, walked over and sort of reached for the woman and said, "Come on in here and bring the dog." And the trooper looked at the officer and said, "But orders are no dogs are allowed." And the officer said, "That's not a dog. That's medicine. Medicine for the mind." So that was, you know, you did have some people who recognized it. And a number of us were incredibly, incredibly distressed by that sort of thing. And so a group of dog experts gathered together, and I was fortunate enough to be sort of invited on this thing, and formed and put out very, very hastily a single folded sheet with instructions for the National Guardsmen who were involved as to what they could do, you know, to save some of the dogs. And then also made up a set of recommendations so that in the future we hoped it would not happen again. And those were distributed to the emergency workers and the troops when Rita hit on the Texas coast. And basically those things instructed people to take their animals with them, bring some food for the animals, take the animals with them. They did. And we didn't have those horrible scenes that we had in Katrina. And hopefully they will remember, you know, for the next year when this happens. Because Some of the people who stayed behind and some of the people who became casualties in Katrina were staying behind because they did not want to abandon the animals that they loved.
Well, what a great feeling for you. They were actually able to make a difference the next time a disaster happened, because you're right. I mean, seeing those dogs is one of the things, the images, at least in my brain, that has never gone away of seeing the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And in a way, I'd go so far as to say that it made Anderson Cooper's career, because all of a sudden he wasn't just this talking head. He was this guy who was playing with the abandoned dogs in Katrina. It humanized him.
Yeah, it really is something that people didn't think about. I spoke with one of the individuals who had done a... They did a simulation, and they were looking at what would happen if a Category 4, whatever it was, hurricane hit the New Orleans area. And... this was being done for FEMA and the U.S. government. And basically, I said to him, well, in your simulation, you know, what did you plan or advise about the family dogs? And he said to me, you know, you could hear this edge in his voice, in which he said, well, our concern was the people. The dogs aren't important.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, the estimate is that 40% of the people who stayed behind, who ignored the instructions to evacuate, said that the reason they were staying behind is because they had a dog or a set of dogs that they couldn't leave.
That's incredibly telling. And I hope that your instructions for people and also the planning for the next disasters and FEMA's planning, the dogs will be included.
Well, if it is, then I feel we've done a good thing. But unfortunately, political memories are very short.
That's true. But the images will stay with us, so maybe. We've got our fingers crossed for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back talking more with Dr. Stanley Coren, who is the author of The Modern Dog, a joyful exploration of how we live with dogs today. He's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and a recognized expert on dog-human interaction. We'll be taking your calls when we come back. The number to call to join in our conversation this morning, tell us why dogs matter to you. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send us email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation, as shoppers are continuing their frugal ways after a small Black Friday surge, and retailers are worried they're not going to have a Merry Christmas. After 1 on Talk of the Nation, the implications of the retail slump. Veronica Rickert back with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the modern dog, the way we live with dogs, and exploring the mutual benefits between humans and dogs. Hoping to take your call this morning at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And we're talking with Dr. Stanley Coren, who is the author of the book, The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today. And we'll go ahead and take a phone call. We have Janine on the line from Green Bay. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Real fine, thank you. Good morning. I took my other dog to a country vet. He said dogs aren't dogs anymore, which they are not. What's going to happen? They're getting more domesticated, more contact with humans. And you know what? I think my dog is psychic.
Why do you think your dog is psychic?
She understands everything I say to her, and she watches my eyes, you know, when I talk to her. And I'm half kidding about that. But
well, you know, there are stories about out there of dogs who know before their owners come home, and that there is that sort of inexpressible bond between humans and dogs.
That's right.
What do you think, Dr. Coren?
Well, dogs are dogs, and they will remain so, but they're no longer wolves, and they're no longer wild canines. I mean, we have been inventing and reinventing dogs continually for at least 14,000 years. And every time our society changes, we tend to modify our dogs. I mean, you know, a simple example is we have modified the hunting dogs to fit our technology. So that, you know, in the early days, before firearms, we had hounds. And hounds are basically independent hunters, and all the hunter has to do is to catch up to them and either, you know, make the final kill if it's a big animal, or get there before the dogs eat the prey. And they don't have to do anything. And then we developed these muzzle-loading muskets. And, you know, that's a slow process. It takes about, you know, 20, 30 seconds before you can load it up. And then you've got a good, clean shot for maybe 25 to 50 yards. So we developed a pointer. And the pointer is this sort of run silent, run deep dog. You know, it moves very quietly, very slowly, then freezes in position, marking where it believes the bird is. The hunter can come up so that he's really very close, so that when the bird is flushed, he actually has a chance to knock it down with that primitive weapon. As the weapons got better, so that we had, you know, single cartridge loading rifles and that sort of thing, we developed setters. Setters move much more quickly. If you run a pair of them, you can sight down the heads of the two setters from when they freeze in position and figure out where the bird is. And then we developed these wonderful shotguns. And so with a shotgun, you can hunt behind spaniels, and we developed the spaniels to do this. Spaniels are totally undisciplined hunters, and they sort of race along and flush everything without any particular warning. Then the Industrial Revolution hit, and all of a sudden, all of the good land for hunting began to disappear, so that hunters were left with scrap land, like marshes and that sort of thing. And so the nature of hunting then changed, because then you had people who were basically building blinds and sitting in the blinds and waiting for the ducks to go fly over. For that, you needed a totally different type of dog. You needed a dog that would remain absolutely quiet, pay attention to you, until you gave it a command, and then go out and fetch the bird after you'd knocked it down. Well, for that, we developed the retrievers. And then later on, as the ducks became sparser, we developed the latest generation of these hunting dogs, which are called the tollers. So we have, for example, the Nova Scotia Duck Tolling Retriever. The tolling is as in tolling the bell to bring in the congregation on a Sunday, for example. And what the tollers do is they're the smallest of the retrievers, little red and white dogs, and they run up and down the edge of the water, twirling around, barking and acting absolutely crazy. So the ducks fly over to see what all the commotion is. They come within the range of the weapon. The hunter knocks them down, and then he turns into a proper retriever. So we are changing dogs continually. And as we're becoming more housebound and needing more companionship, we are creating a whole new line of companion dogs that we never had before. So you have, you know, wonderful dogs, which came. One of the first companion dogs was the little Maltese. We have pictures of the Maltese actually on in pyramids in Egypt. Little frou-frou dogs, which were on tiny little leashes, really not working dogs. Well, now we have some generations which are quieter versions of the Maltese, which are, you know, very attentive to people. So some of those are fairly rare, like the Coton de Tulier and the Havanese, but some of them are more common, like the Bichon Frise kind of a thing. So we're developing all the time. And each of these dogs has a place. And see, that's the beauty of it. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to write The Modern Dog. I wanted to say, hey, wait a minute, look, you know, we're inserting these dogs into our lives, and we're changing them so they actually fit our lives. So that's the issue about, you know, whether or not they become dogs. Now, whether or not they're psychic, no, they're not psychic. But dogs are the absolute masters of body language. I mean, just imagine, if you will, a pack of wolves, who are the ancestors of dogs, and they sight a deer, and the leader of the pack yells, hey guys, look, there's a deer over there. Well, guess what? The deer has just heard it, and the dogs have lost lunch. So dogs have become the masters of body language. And what psychologists know is that you express a huge amount of your emotional state in your body language. And dogs read that. And they look at you and, you know, obviously this is going to go through their heads in a much more primitive fashion, but they look at that and say, Mom or Dad needs some loving. And they come over and they provide you that kind of affection.
You know what's neat about that is that all of us really want a friend who knows exactly what we're thinking, even if we don't have to say anything, sort of like the perfect friendship, you know, between Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. You know, you're looking for the perfect friend, and maybe dogs are that friend because they have that ability.
It's exactly that. And dogs give what psychologists call unconditional positive regard. That's just a sexy way of saying that regardless of what you do, the dog still loves you and still gives you affection. And there's a marvelous study which was conducted a couple of years back in which they looked at divorce rates in couples which owned dogs and those which did not. And they found that the divorce rate was lower in the couples which owned dogs. And if you stop and you think about it for a second, I mean, the reasons behind that should be quite obvious. I mean, you know, you've just had a ratty day. And you come home, and you really need some TLC. And you open the door, and there your partner is, and they've just had an absolutely ratty day. And if you make demands for their affection at that particular point in time, that's apt to start a fight, and things are apt to get tense. On the other hand, there's Lassie meeting you at the door saying, love me, love me, love me. And so you bend down and you say hello to Lassie, and that touch starts to make you feel better, and you put less of a demand on your partner, and so the cumulative negative effects which might build up in a relationship don't build up, and your relationship goes on. And the reason is the catalyst which the dog has served as.
Let's go back to the phones right now. We've got another call from, I think it's Frederico in Madison. Hi, Frederico.
Hi, this is Frederico.
Frederico, all right, thank you.
I had one question, actually, but now that you're talking about if the dogs are psychic or how they read body language, I have an interesting story. We go to Mexico once a year, and we hike in the Sierra Madre, and our neighbor, German Shepherd, his name was Rambo, and we used to take him hiking with us. And with this one time, two girls came along with my wife and I, and these two girls got left behind. And we stopped. We waited for them for 10 minutes. They never showed up. And out of the blue, I just thought of telling the dog to go back and get them. And I said to Rambo in Spanish, I said, Rambo, go get them. And sure enough, he took off running. And about 10 minutes later, he came back with those two girls.
Hmm.
Now, those two girls were not on the same trail we were on. They got lost. So, I mean, this dog did find those two girls.
And
so that's kind of neat how, I don't know if it was my command, cause I, you know, or my body language, because I pointed to the directions that the girls were supposed to come from.
Yeah,
but sure enough, that dog, that was kind of neat.
And, Frederico, did you have another question as well?
Yes, I do. I wanted to ask the expert there on dogs. My wife and I have never owned a dog. We have four kids, and I've always wanted a dog. Now, she wants a dog. She says if we ever get a dog, it has to be a dog that can live outdoors. I don't know if there's such a dog, because she will not admit the dog in the house.
A husky. What do you think, Dr. Stanley Carl?
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that where you are located, a dog who lives outdoors has to be able to deal with cold weather. And the dogs which handle those best are the dogs which are derived from the Spitz. The Spitz, you can think of the Spitz as the great granddaddy of all the husky-type dogs. So he had pricked ears, and he had that double coat and that big bushy tail which sort of comes up over his back. And the best of all of those dogs for sort of outside use is the Malamute. One of the reasons is that they're less active than the Siberian Husky, which is another good choice for that sort of thing if you want a dog which is smaller. But they can, in fact, live outdoors. People who live in the north, I mean, the Malamute actually gets its name from an Eskimo tribe, which were called the Malamut. And the dogs were left outside most of the time and would sort of burrow into the snow to keep warm. But if you just have an insulated doghouse outside and some sort of safe area where the dog can stay, then a Malamute would be a good choice. It's a big dog. So if you want a smaller dog than that, then you should probably get a Siberian Husky.
Is that a good life for a dog, though, living outside and not being admitted to the house?
It's not my preferred, no. Dogs are much happier when they're with people. They're much happier being inside. And there's all sorts of benefits from having a dog inside. One of the benefits is safety. There have been a couple of studies which have shown that if you have a dog who is in your house, and that's a dog who barks, because it's a barking, which is the important thing, you reduce the likelihood of your house being broken into to 1/7. That's more than twice as effective as having, you know, big prominent signs saying that we've got electronic security systems and that sort of thing.
What if you have an old deaf dog like we have? I suppose the presence of a dog, if they don't bark, isn't much use.
Well, an old deaf dog, I mean, one of the first things which you should do when you have a dog is you should dual train the dog. And this is something which we've always done. And dual training the dog means you train the dog to both signals and voice commands.
Well, that's interesting because she has picked up. Now we sort of just communicate with her with hand gestures, which sort of evolved organically, not intentionally, but that's how we do our communication now.
Well, that's we recommend that people do that from the get-go. So you want your dog to sit, you tell the dog sit, and you do a sort of big scooping motion up in front of the dog's face. And you want the dog to go down, and you raise your hand up and then drop it, kind of a thing. And if you do that, because, you know, some dogs become blind when they get older, some become deaf. So this gives you another channel for communicating with the dog. But there are two things which you should really think about if you have a deaf dog. The first thing is you have to be very careful when the dog is sleeping, because if you awaken the dog, you know, he didn't hear you coming. And he might get startled and he might snap, or certainly be very upset about the thing. So one of the things which we tell people to do is when you're approaching the dog, be very heavy-footed, you know, stamp your feet so the dog sort of feels the vibration coming. And if you want to waken the dog, just hold your hand in front of the dog's nose. Your smell will usually waken him.
Really?
Or get the dog very used to always being touched in exactly the same place. Another thing which you should do, and this will sound counterintuitive, is to hang a bell on your dog's collar. The reason for this is that, you know, obviously the bell is not going to help the dog per se because he can't hear it. But the thing is the dog can't hear you. And so if you go to call him or whatever else, and if he has a bell on his collar, then you can hear where he's at, even if he's unresponsive to you.
Ah. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you for those tips. That's good stuff to know. And we'll take another call now before break. Here is Dana with us from Oshkosh. Hi, Dana.
Hi. Thank you. Dr. Korn, my question's a little more cultural psychology and orientation, but there are cultures today that revile dogs, that consider them the lowest of the low. And what do you think, if your hypothesis about dogs and mental health is correct, what does that say about the mental health or I guess our ability as a dog-loving culture to relate to cultures that don't share that?
Well, the cultures which tend to revile dogs tend to have one of two reasons behind it. And one of it is religious, because there are some religions, such as Islam and that sort of thing, fundamentalist Islam, which feel the touch of the dog is unclean. And the other has to do with health concerns. It's very difficult for us here in North America to understand this, but rabies is a major problem, mostly through the Middle East and through Asia and Africa. And rabies is you know, once you've got it, if you're in a culture which really doesn't have high-tech medicine, you know, you're gone, and it's a miserable, ugly kind of a death. And so you get some cultures which avoid dogs simply because of the fact that they're associated with this potential problem. And there, if you could solve the health problem, and that's just simply by inoculating dogs, you know, then the culture changes right away. And that's happening right now in China, for example, where they have a one child per family rule. And the government found out that, you know, people really chafed about that. But they chafed a lot less if they were also allowed to have one dog. And they began to put some restrictions on dogs because of the rise of rabies. And when they did that, there was some unrest in the population. So now they're just encouraging and making available rabies shots, inoculations for the dogs. And that's beginning to solve the problem. But it's important to note that even in those cultures which don't like dogs or consider them unclean, there are always exceptions. So, for example, there's a story which is told in Islam, which goes that the governor of Medina came to Muhammad and said, and requested that he be allowed to put to death all the dogs in his province because they had a huge outbreak of rabies. And at first, Muhammad agreed that then, you know, all the dogs of Islam would be put down. But then it suddenly dawned upon him that he had dogs. I mean, he tended to hunt behind Salukis, and that would then include his dog. So he revised his edict so that any dogs which were working dogs, which were dogs that had a function, so they were either hunters or guards or herdsmen or that sort of thing, would be spared. And the only dogs that had to be put to death were four-eyed dogs. And four-eyed dogs are those dark dogs who have yellow spots either above or below their eyes. So it looks as though they have four eyes. And his reasoning was because they were still in league with the devil.
Interesting. Well, we need to take another break right now, and then we'll be back taking more phone calls from you at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234 to share your dog questions or comments. Tell us why your dog matters to you. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Stanley Coren, who is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia, and he's the author of The Modern Dog. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11 o'clock today, Larry Mueller and his guests take a look at the oddball world of ice fishing. Lane Kennedy and Greg Brining are the authors of A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. That's coming up at 11 o'clock today. Right now, we are ensconced in the world of dogs with our guest Stanley Coren, who is the author of The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Going back to the phones now, let's get a call in from Anne in Neenah. Hi, Anne.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say that your guest seems to think that this, you know, sort of mystical connection with dogs is universal, and I don't feel it. I've lived 40 years. I've never had a relationship with a dog. My husband hasn't. You know, in fact, I guess I kind of resent all the people who assume that I want their dog near me, on me, around me. I don't feel it. And I also think that there is a sense in which people prefer the company of dogs because it's much easier. You know, in our town, there are more concern sometimes paid to the Humane Society shelter than to the homeless shelter for human beings. And I just, you know, would your guests say that I'm, you know, some sort of an anomaly, or that my mental health, you know, isn't as good as somebody else who is connected to dogs? Because I've lived perfectly fine without any connection or relationship with dog whatsoever, and that's, you know, fine with me. I'm just curious what your guest would say about that.
Well, let me ask you a question before we throw it to our guest. Are you a cat person, or are you just not an animal person, period?
Well, I guess I would, you know, prefer cats, but, you know, I have no ill will towards animals. I just don't feel this innate, you know, sort of bond with dogs. I mean, I see dogs running around, jumping on people, and, you know, I don't really necessarily trust them around my children. I've seen children get bitten by dogs before at picnics and things, and, you know, I don't understand this sort of intensity, and to me it seems like anthropomorphizing, that people just have the fantasy in their minds that they have these great relationships with these animals, and really it's a fantasy, you know. But I guess I'm sort of coming from the opposite end of the spectrum, but my husband feels the same way. We don't have any ill will towards them, but we just don't have any need or desire to have any relationship with the dog.
Well, it's a great question, Anne, and thank you for raising that. What do you think, Dr. Stanley Korn? What about people who really don't feel that bond with dogs?
Well, part of it is a socialization thing. I mean, if you grow up without any contact with dogs when you're young, then, in fact, the likelihood that you will have any fondness for dogs when you're older is greatly, greatly reduced. And in some respects, it's simply because, I mean, here's this thing with teeth and, you know, an unpredictable behavior, and you don't know quite what to do with it, and you don't make the right kinds of responses to the animal, and so the animal doesn't respond in its sort of typical friendly way toward you. And it's just a matter of sort of learning and socialization. Now, no, there's nothing wrong with a person who doesn't particularly like animals. I mean, there are some people who don't particularly like people. But the idea somehow or another that the substitute, that dogs are somehow, you know, a substitute for people, and that people care more about dogs than they do about human beings is far, is very, very wrong. Because you can show, for example, that people who are pet owners are much more likely to give money to charities than people who are not pet owners. So that essentially means that these are people who have a higher level of caring. And probably one of the best examples of this is the case of Henry Berg. Henry Berg actually founded the SPCA in North America. And he did so because he was seeing animals being abused and that sort of thing. And anyway, he was building the SPCA and had played a significant role in getting some of the animal welfare laws passed. And one day, a woman came to him and said, "Mr. Berg, I know that you care about animals, but maybe you can help me. There's this little girl who's living in a tenement, which I'm living in, and she's being very, very badly abused." So Berg basically got a chance to take a look at this child, and she was in dreadful, dreadful shape. Unfortunately, at that point in time, the laws were such that a parent could do whatever they wanted with a child, you know, other than killing them, without any consequences. They had full control. And this absolutely horrified Berg. So he basically had the child's caretakers brought to court, and they brought this little girl in on a blanket, and he laid the child down in front of the judge, and it was sort of pitiful kind of a scene. And Berg said, you know, we have laws which protect the welfare of animals. At the very least, this child should be considered to be an animal and should have the same kind of protection. And they actually convicted the people of violation of the animal welfare law. And Berg went on to found basically the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And that society still exists. It now has several different names because it's been divided into state kinds of things. And they used to have offices in the same place as the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And they went on to get the child welfare laws, you know, moving, which had not been done before. So the idea that somehow or another the people who have the fondness and the concern about dogs, you know, are doing so at the cost of their fondness or concern about humans is wrong. These are, in fact, the people who respond positively to the dogs because apparently it appears to be in their nature to respond positively to living things.
Well, Dr. Stanley Korn, I want to thank you for being with us today. It's been a wonderful hour, and I wish you best of luck with your book.
Thank you for having me, and keep warm.
We'll do our best. Right. It might be a three-dog night tonight.
You got it.
Dr. Stanley Korn, we've been talking to. He's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia and a recognized expert on dog-human interaction. He's the author of several books, including the one we were talking about this morning, called The Modern Dog, A Joyful Exploration of How We Live with Dogs Today. Thank you to Brittany DeAnda for answering phones this morning and to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for production. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 1222E. And thank you for listening this morning. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.